It's now my pleasure to introduce the second part of the one-two punch, otherwise known as Murderer's Row of former NRC chairman. And that's Dick Reserve.
Well, needless to say, I'm really wired up for this talk. I'm really extraordinarily pleased to have the opportunity to speak here today. I met Frank Parker in a somewhat different context than the rest of you, I think over 25 years ago, and I hired him as an expert witness in a case, and Frank testified for me before a court in Illinois where we were dealing with an issue having to do with the disposal of radioactive waste. In this case, it was thorium mill tailings, and I saw Frank as an exceptionally competent witness on direct, but I was really extraordinarily pleased with his performance on cross-examination and that he really totally destroyed the rather uppity state's attorney who was attacking him. And it was just a terrific job. I think that all of you know Frank and know how he has the capability to put down people when necessary. And this was amply demonstrated in this instance. I also learned, however, that he was quite disappointed with the hotel food on which we were living at the time. So I've had many interactions with Frank over the years, and I'm really pleased that I was invited to join you this morning. My conversation this morning is going to be about the legal framework concerning the disposal of spent fuel and high-level waste at Yucca Mountain. I'm going to describe the framework very, very briefly because it's familiar to everyone here, and I'll focus on some of the lessons that I think should be learned. Let me say that these are, following Bill Colglazier's example, are going to be lessons from the 30,000-foot level. I have a particular challenge this morning in that I think many of the lessons that I've drawn have already been expressed by previous speakers, so I apologize for that. Well, the licensing framework, as all of you know, is extraordinarily complicated. There are three responsible federal agencies, DOE, which is to construct the construct and operate the facility, EPA, which is obliged to set general standards, the NRC, which is then required to license and regulate the site in a fashion consistent with the EPA standards. There are special roles, as has been mentioned earlier, at various stages for the president, for affected states, in particular Nevada, affected Indian tribes, and the Congress. And of course, at the end of the process, there are opportunities for review of decisions at all these levels in the courts. If one looks at this process, one would, from the outside, one would say that whoever wrote this Rube Goldberg device that we have for licensing Yucca Mountain must have trusted no one. So they've sort of allocated the responsibility here and there and set up an elaborate system of what was apparently intended to be checks and balances, which posed the risk, I suppose, of administrative stalemate. And in fact, that's what we're seeing. The relevant standards, EPA standards, were remanded. The DC Circuit vacated the standards in July of 2004. EPA has not yet promulgated them 3.5 years later. And of course, once EPA promulgates the standards, then the NRC and DOE have the obligation to re-promulgate their standards to bring them into conformance with the EPA standards. The delay is reported to be the result of interagency conflict in the process, and I don't know the details of what's going on, but it is inherently plausible to me that that should be the case, and that on the remand, there's an obligation to EPA to set standards for this period that might extend as long as 1 million years, and in the proposed rule, they had proposed a 350 millirem standard. If I were in the Justice Department now and had to defend that standard, I'd want to push my client to say as much as they could about that being protective, and I can well understand that EPA has a great problem saying very much about a standard that's as large as 350 millirems, given all their other standards dealing with radiation in one way or another, for fear that they've they open the door in one area, they then have problems in all their other standards. So this is an area where there no doubt is, understandably, a huge amount of internal controversy. I don't know that that's what the problem is, but I can well imagine that that's the sort of thing that must be very difficult to iron out, where you not only need to promulgate standard, but you do need to able to defend them once you've done it in the courts. And that may put some of the agencies in an awkward position. Well, we are also as well in something close to a political stalemate. We have the prospect of an administrative stalemate. We have the prospect of a political stalemate. Senator Reid is obviously adamantly opposed to Yucca Mountain. As the Senate Majority Leader, he's in a uniquely powerful position. Frank Parker noted at the very beginning that in this recent omnibus appropriation bill, he characterized Yucca Mountain as a dying beast. And with the cut in funding that he was able to achieve, he believes he's driven, in his words, the final nail in the coffin. Now, I don't think he's done that, but obviously there was less funding that was provided than DOE had sought. And so that this no doubt is going to prove somewhat of a challenge for the program now and on into the future in light of the problems that Ward indicated is if they have an opportunity to go forward with construction, and that the appropriation process can be used as a vehicle to strangle the program. This no doubt has a continuing frictions that result between DOE and the Congress just about all of these things. And I have to note as well that every Democratic candidate has indicated that he or she opposes Yucca Mountain. And so there's obviously a political prospect of a stalemate that may continue on in future years. So I conclude that we've been all these years at this, and we obviously are having great problems in getting the site licensed, and the procedural part of this process is certainly far from optimal. But I do think that there are several lessons that should be learned. I hope that other countries who are envisioning disposal of nuclear waste will learn them. We basically have an example of how not to do it in the United States. And if Yucca Mountain fails, and I'm not saying it will, it may be necessary to rethink the approach here. We heard Ward Sproat this morning. I'm not sure that he's still here, but we have a situation where he's obviously a very capable fellow, and he is playing the hand he was dealt very capably. But he obviously has a very hard job in pushing this thing forward. If it does fail, we need to rethink how we're proceeding, and I'm not saying it will, but we no doubt have to proceed, and of course we are, but I would have to say that from my distance, one would think that this is a process that's certainly threatened at the moment at the best. Well, what lessons can we draw? There are many lessons that might be drawn from Yucca Mountain, and let me suggest first is something that is really perhaps something that was not much on Congress's mind when we first got into this business, but has been very much in the fore lately, which is the thought that the United States over time may get into the reprocessing business. And if we do, that obviously has an impact on what you're going to be putting into any disposal site. And if one does proceed along this course, and I'm not saying we should, but if we do, one would need to think about waste disposal as one component of an integrated system for nuclear power. One shouldn't optimize just one part of the system. One should look at the entirety of it and make sure that you've reached the right societal balance across the whole spectrum, going from the uranium mining and milling through the fuel fabrication, through the recycling of the perhaps fast reactors one might use, and on into waste disposal. It has been argued that the possibilities there, of course, may be attractive and that it might cause the waste disposal problem to be made somewhat easier with the process of transmutation, separating the fission products. But I don't want to get into the merits of this one way or another, but if this is a track we're going to take, one should look at the entirety of the system and do an evaluation where one considers all of the relevant factors across the whole system, and that there may be costs that one is prepared to incur on one part of the system that are larger than would otherwise be the case, because they save you a whole lot of money at another end of the system, as an example of the sort of cross-thinking that one should do. And in this context, one will ought to be considering environmental performance, safety and security, proliferation, possibly extension of the fuel supply in the longer term, and critically economics. All of them should be, many other factors should be part of the calculus. But in any event, what I'm suggesting is that one should design a system that achieves an optimal balance across all of these factors. One can do so, and to look, not look at any one component in isolation from all the others. R&D is obviously an essential part of this process that I've described. We have the time if we need to take this step, and that it's my view, and it's been expressed by others here, that we can safely store the spent fuel in dry gas storage if we had to, in a fashion that's safe and secure for the necessary periods. The second point that I'd raise is that site selection should be made on the merits by an open and transparent process. The legal history surrounding Yucca Mountain is well known to you. Congress started it in 1982 in the Nuclear Waste Policy Act. The federal government was to assume responsibility for the disposal of spent fuel. It placed responsibility on various federal agencies and so forth. And DOE started on the process of evaluating sites, ultimately coming forward with three sites for actual detailed characterization: Deaf Smith County in Texas, Hanford, and Yucca Mountain. So with these three sites sort of pending for further evaluation, Congress then departed from the system in the Nuclear Waste Policy Act amendments in 1987 and directed that Yucca Mountain was to be the site. This was said to be justified on cost and delay. And Tom Cochran referred to this as the Screw Nevada Act, as you heard. And then, of course, in 1992, there were some follow-up activities in the Energy Policy Act with EPA and NRC given some further directions on how they were to develop their standards, again, with standards focusing on Yucca Mountain. This process, in my view, established a grievance by Nevada that as a weak site, as a weak state politically, it had been selected as Nevada's dumping grounds. And I think that just assured opposition. It is noteworthy to me in this context that the Nevadans, as best I know, are very proud of the presence of the Nevada test site in their state. And it, of course, has radioactive contaminants that are present in largely uncontrolled circumstances in underground cavities. Of course, the total number of curies is far less. But the difference in approach, I think, between the Nevadans' attitude toward the test facility and Yucca Mountain is very much by the national security component, I think, that John Ahern mentioned, the difference in time, and I think as well the process by which Yucca Mountain was defined as the location. It is worth contrasting our experience in this area with Finland and Sweden. We're going to hear about Sweden, I think, later this afternoon, but those countries' sites are competing. City communities are competing against each other to be selected as the disposal site. Seems astonishing to us here. But my point is that we, I think, would have been far better off if we'd taken the time and done site selection by an open process. It was transparent. People understood it. Done on the merits. With full public involvement in order to provide public acceptability. I'm not so Pollyannish to think that everyone would have been happy. The kind of acceptability that they were able to get apparently in the Scandinavian countries may not be something that's achievable in our society. But at least the sense of grievance would be reduced. And that you may not like the decision, but if it was achieved by a fair process, I think that the intensity of the opposition would be less. The third point I'd make is that, in my view, the licensing paradigm that we're applying at Yucca Mountain is really quite a poor fit to the task of long-term waste disposal. The licensing approach with which the NRC is familiar involves the submission of an application, detailed, very thorough application, in which it's demonstrated that the facility to be licensed will meet all the necessary standards over the whole life cycle of the facility. And of course, this example of that is a nuclear power plant where you worry about lifetime start to finish of perhaps a century or so. And the approach that it basically has is its premise that one can reasonably evaluate the full environmental impacts right at the outset and can assess them and make judgments about them as you start. And that the idea is that let the public stakeholders have a full view of every aspect of the site right at the outset in analysis of the full life cycle. And this really is required by the National Environmental Policy Act, where the idea that one might start a project by evaluating only a segment of the environmental impacts is viewed as just letting the nose of the camel get in the tent, and that once you've launched on that path, then you've made a commitment with perhaps as later parts of the project coming on that there be environmental impacts that you wish you'd considered before you let the project get started. So this does reflect a sensible legal rule that segmentation is improper. One ought to evaluate everything from the outset, make a judgment about that, and proceed. The reason I think that this is a poor paradigm for us for a disposal program is just this issue that Frank mentioned at the beginning, is that there's maybe some aspects of repository performance that are subject to fair evaluation for periods that extend perhaps as long as hundreds of thousands of years, but there are others that are just critically important to whether there are going to be real effects that are not subject to certainty. And of course, there are things like climate change, the state of technology, how people are living, what the disposition of people are. All of those things are factors that are going to affect what the real risks are, and they're ones that are not going to be susceptible to reasonable evaluation from the outset. So there's going to be significant uncertainty associated with the site, and I know that John Garrick is, I understand it, will be talking about some of the difficulties and even the more standard geologic analyses that would need to be undertaken. So we have the reality that we do not know everything that could reasonably affect performance over an extended time period, and as you know, the D.C. Circuit decision requires an evaluation out to the period of geologic stability that could be as long as a million years. And that issues such as societal patterns, climate change, technological capacity, and on, all could affect things. It's my view, and this is also consistent with what was said earlier by Frank and some others, is that we need to be considerably more flexible. We ought not to have the hubris of thinking that we know enough today to be able to define the whole future. This was a point I think that Bill Koglaser made as well. Our goal should do the best we can with the best engineering judgment that provides a promise of isolating the waste over the necessary long periods of time, but don't pretend that we have the capacity to judge everything. We should feel our way along. We should try to be preserving options in order to approach this, that as we learn, we can adapt to the situation. Always be protective as you proceed, but not put yourself in the posture where you pretend to have the capability to evaluate all the factors that are necessary over the extended long time period. And this is, as mentioned, is an approach that has been urged by the academies. It is seen by the NRC as being inconsistent with their licensing obligations. The fourth factor I'd mention, and this is perhaps one that is beyond our capability, but this is really stepping back maybe to the 100,000-foot level from the 30,000-foot level. And it's just urged that we start to think as a society about more harmonized approaches to risk. It is anticipated that the EPA standards will require the repository to meet the whole body standard for a period of up to a million years. The standards are expected to be repromulgated as to the first 10,000 years with the approach that had been in the previous version, which was 15 millirem whole body and 4 millirem through a groundwater pathway. It is really striking if one stands back and thinks about how these standards compare with other things that bear on the issue. chemical waste, hazardous chemical waste, are disposed of under the Resource Conservation and Recovery Act of EPA, consistent with EPA requirements. There is a post-closure monitoring regime for hazardous waste site. It extends for 30 years. You're obliged to monitor the site and verify that the site is performing as predicted, and then that's the extent of the obligation. And the risks from chemical hazardous waste, in many cases, might plausibly be significantly greater than those from the Yucca Mountain site. One could say, well, radiation is special, radionuclides are special, and that with just the public attitudes are different, and that is something that is a reality that we need to confront. But even if one looks within the realm of radiation regulations and requirements, I just observe that if I look in my Sunday paper, the Washington Post, I can find an opportunity to go to a clinic and I can have a CT scan, that whole body CT scan that will be undertaken without any doctor saying that I should have a CT scan, but I can pony up the money because I just like to know what's going on in my body, and a professional will evaluate that. But nonetheless, it's me choosing, or a member of the public is allowed to choose to go in. So I can walk into the doctor's office and I can have a CT scan with a resulting dose of several REM. And one really has to wonder whether it's plausible to be spending billions of dollars to avert a few millirem in several hundred thousand years when, in an uncontrolled way, I can walk into a doctor's office and get several REM and without any apparent consideration of the comparative risks. Again, it's different. It's a voluntarily incurred risk. If they were even disclosed that there is a risk, it may not be. But it's a different circumstances. In my view, these differences, this gulf is so great that one can really question the rationality of the overall system. Now, it may well be that one should decide that medical exposures of this nature ought to be tightened and chemical exposures ought to be reduced rather than the Yucca Mountain standard, but there's an incommensurate exposure to risk here that is worth evaluating, I think. I'm not saying which way it should go, but this current system just seems absolutely crazy to me. The fifth point I'd make is that I think we really do need to rethink our obligations to future generations, the so-called intergenerational risk issue, and this is something that's been touched on by the others. It is not customary, as we look at standards that protective in the future, to discount the protection of future generations. And the reality is, if you do discount those risks and their very distant impacts, such as would be projected to occur for Yucca Mountain, that would mean the risks would be ignored. I mean, they would be reduced effectively to zero, and the impacts could be ignored. And any such approach, I think, is appropriately seen as presenting some ethical concerns. The generation that obtained the benefit of an activity should bear the costs of as well. And you shouldn't oblige future generations to bear risks. But on the other hand, one has to wonder whether it's rational to spend billions of dollars today to protect a hypothetical person hundreds of thousands of years in the future. And I'm not saying that this is that exactly how one resolves the question, but it does seem to me the scope and nature of the risk in the future, that it might be a limited number of people, likely would be a limited number of people, that the risk would not be catastrophic, this great uncertainty in the risk, all ought to be factors that one ought to be weighing in this process. And I'm not saying that one should neglect this issue of our obligation to protect future generations, but I'm not sure we have the balance right today. Well, I'm sure that there are many other lessons that could be drawn from the Yucca Mountain experience. These are just a few, and I hope that at least some of them resonated with you. Thank you.